Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight we're going to
read you some news and play some audios. Our interview that we had for some reason didn't get recorded. We're having trouble down there. Leo couldn't do it properly, so hopefully next week we'll have a good interview to bring you. I'm sorry you can't.
Hope so.
Because it was a good interview. It was with Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator of the AFSCME Union, and I'm really sorry it didn't get recorded properly. But we're going to bring you some news, and let's get right to it.
Yeah. If you just wait a second here, I had some... I thought this was interesting. Secret human RFID implanting, how and why. Amongst the greatest violations of human rights and everything, the
United States stands for, is the secretly forcing RFID chips into humans without their knowledge or consent, as James Walbert and an untold number of American children and adults are experiencing. In the majestic picture production documentary trailer below, a whistleblower explains how and why he was covertly implanted by a dentist. The retired Sacramento, California firefighter paramedic whistleblower film testimony reinforces the four-part examiner series, secretly forced brain implants, including dentistry involvement in the new wave of criminal activity targeting innocent people of integrity.
So this is a...
That's pretty scary.
Yeah. Actually, there's more, and we'll go to this... I just want to read this, and then we'll go to the actual...
Secretly forced brain, part one, explosive court case. Please see the follow-up article. There isn't any more.
Okay, there's just a few series, just a few into this. We'll look back.
And let's just
play. Okay, let's play this trailer here for this RFID.
Majestic Picture Production presents.
My name is Jesse Beltran. I'm a retired Sacramento City firefighter paramedic. I was on duty and I heard a dispatch call go for a kidnapping of a 4 or 5 year old girl. We heard law enforcement in pursuit of the vehicle. And they apprehended the suspect in North Sacramento on Manzanita Avenue between Auburn and Madison. We had a sense that something was going to go wrong, so we were listening on the radio and we ended up being right there on scene as they apprehended the suspect. Suspect out of the vehicle through the passenger side. We witnessed him being beat up and eventually he was beaten to death. We continued to do CPR on the gentleman. We loaded him up on the gurney and we went code 3 to University Medical Center. You see, it was a trauma center here in Sacramento. All the way into the trauma room, and I can remember the look on Lifeline Nurses' face. We were all very close-knit family, and they looked at the gentleman and saw how badly beaten he'd been, and their comment was, and I recall it just like yesterday, that this wasn't right. They left the room. They didn't want to have anything to do with this call because it had to do with law enforcement. The following day after this incident, I tried to report this to my supervisors, and me being a young man of only 23 years old at the time, was told to keep my mouth shut, that the sheriff's department would beat the living daylights out of us, and they would blacklist us. Both Craig Stevens and myself wanted to write a report, but we're told not to.
To the EU entirely.
I hope they do. hope they break that up. And no content with national governments.
Not content.
Not content. With national governments from every member countries already sending a taxpayer money to the bloated anti-democratic EU bureaucracy, globalists in Brussels are now desperate to sink their teeth in future.
In further.
Why don't you read that?
In an effort to increase their budget by 6%, even in the midst of a national debt crisis which affects the majority of European nations, the unelected bastards in Brussels are set to once again display their insatiable appetite for power and taxpayers' money, as MP Douglas Carswell warns. By flexing the muscles of their completely illegitimate and autocratic voting system to loot taxpayers of whatever meager accounts of disposable income they have left. Options expected to be proposed in the EU report today include levies on carbon emissions, air transport, financial transactions, or bank profits. There could even be extra taxes on petrol, gasoline, reports the Express.
According to an RTE report, the EU could even push for its own European-wide VAT tax on top of the 20% plus VAT tax people in Europe already pay.
The VAT is short for value-added tax.
Now, excuse me, fully aware of the fact that direct EU tax will cause a huge backlash and potentially mass civil disobedience among those forced to pay it, EU bureaucrats have advised officials to avoid using the word tax because it would be politically explosive. So having a supply of healthy food that lasts as high, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, as UK independence auto Euro MP Marta
Andreasen points out, however the tax is applied, it will ultimately impact individual citizens. If it is slapped on banks, they will pass the cost on to the customer. The taxpayer will always be the loser. The commission is outrageous and deceitful, said Andreasen. Is there no end to the ceaseless financial raping and pillaging globalists think they are entitled to conduct with wanton abandon and supreme arrogance? European citizens are all being told they must endure the most severe and crippling austerity measures in modern history, as pensions are seized, retirement ages hiked, public services cut, and all manner of existing taxes raised. And now this, the corrupt, unrepresentative, and widely despised EU wants to get in on the feeding frenzy. The reason people hate it is these are appointed bureaucrats.
Yeah,
they're not even elected,
and they're in charge of the whole thing. These guys, they shouldn't be there. They just shouldn't even be there.
Europeans should follow the example of the French and organize mass resistance to any proposal for a direct EU tax. Once the globalists are allowed to get their hands in our pockets, the looting will know no bounds. The elite are desperate to build a national sovereignty, crushing European federal superstates as part of the march toward world government, and they're going to make the victims of that process pay for the privilege. EU President Herman Van Rompuy made it clear what the ultimate agenda was when he told fellow globalists that the European Union was committed to exploiting the financial crises and the fraudulent global warming scam to ram through the global management of our planet. Globally managing a planetary dictatorship doesn't come cheap, which is why the slaves are going to pay for it if the EU has its way. Oh, and here's a little clip so we can hear what they have to say. New EU president confirms new world order.
Right, let's try this one.
The position to which you have just elected me is a new one, and I shall take office on the 1st of January 2010. The Lisbon Treaty wanted to instill greater continuity and coherence in the work of the European Council of Heads of State and Government. Six monthly presidencies has the advantage of involving all 27 member states in the work of the Union. The disadvantage was a lack of perspective. It's my firm intention to ensure that our work develops over a long-term period. A perspective that goes beyond 6 months will allow us to be better organized where the major multi-annual dossiers are concerned, such as the financial perspectives and the Lisbon strategy. I also think that going back to our roots in the European Council could help us to discuss from time to time, in an informal and open way, the big questions of the European project. I'm thinking more specifically of the economic and social agenda, and this is a particularly urgent matter because of the environmental and energy challenges we face and the aspirations we have for greater security and justice for all our fellow citizens. We're living through exceptionally difficult times. The financial crisis and its dramatic impact on employment and budgets, the climate crisis which threatens our very survival, a period of anxiety, uncertainty and lack of confidence. Yet these problems can be overcome by a joint effort in and between our countries. 2009 is also the first year of global governance with the establishment of the G20 in the middle of the financial crisis. The climate conference in Copenhagen is another step towards the global management of our planet. Our mission, our presidency, is one of hope, supported by acts and by deeds.
So they want to take, they already had their first meeting.
Yeah.
In G20 on global governance. Kind of vast, I'll tell you.
Yep.
Oh, this is a good one. Foreclosure mill gave employees jewelry, cars, houses to forge documents. According to sworn statements already by the Florida Attorney General's office, one of the state's foreclosure mills bribed employees with jewelry, cars, and houses to forge and alter documents required by court conducting foreclosure proceedings. Kelly Scott and Mary Cordova, two former employees of Florida Attorney David J. Stern, were close to the process. Both described to investigators a secretive system designed to speed up foreclosures, and their testimony seemed to match up with claims made by Tammy Lou Kupusta and other former Stern employee.
The statements were published online Monday afternoon. The two former Stern's employees described long tables where employees would sign as a witness and notarized documents without actually witnessing the signing, reporter Shannon Benekin noted, writing for Tampa Bay Online. Twice a day, Scott said the company's chief operating officer, Cheryl Sammons, would go into the office and sign 500 documents at a time without reading them. Their revelation comes on the heels of a recent controversy over so-called robo-signers who were employed by finance firms as mortgage experts when their real capacity was to move as much paper as possible with little regard for the facts. The alleged mortgage experts were employed by firms like Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, and Goldman Sachs. In the week of the controversy, major lenders like Bank of America and Chase froze some foreclosures to review the paperwork. Bank of America said Monday it would resume foreclosures later this week. The Obama administration has resisted calls for a national moratorium on foreclosures, with spokesman Robert Gates warning of the unintended consequences of such an action. Didn't we hear that if we didn't bail out the banks?
Yeah.
While many House Democrats, including Speaker Nancy Pelosi, have called for a congressional investigation into foreclosure fraud, Congress is widely expected to pass legislation retroactively forgiving the mortgage industry for its abuses.
Oh, my God.
Sick. Attorneys general in 50 states have launched probes into foreclosure practices.
I just heard or read that Pelosi may step down.
because she's so hated?
Yeah, and to help her own to help the Democratic campaign of others. Wouldn't be a bad idea.
Matt Taibbi, magic money printing machine at the Fed. Oh, this should be interesting.
Yeah, this is about 7 months long, though, but,
yeah.
But I think it's worth it. The money from the Federal Reserve goes directly to the banks.
There are some journalists like Matt Taibbi at Rolling Stone who are now reporting that the Fed might do another round of quantitative easing. That sounds complicated, right? But it's actually very simple. Just mean the Fed is going to print more money. They already printed $1 trillion during the bailouts. Now they might print more. Do you know what they do with the money they print? You're going to be shocked, so I hope you're sitting down. Turns out they give it to the banks. I didn't see that coming. In the first QE, as the cool kids call it, they did some quantitative easing of the banks by buying up their toxic mortgages. In the new round, they would again let the banks unload more of their troublesome mortgages on the Fed. In fact, this is the new way to do bailouts. Gretchen Morgan said of the New York Times reported last week that there's a giant loophole in the finance reform bill that allows the Fed to rescue the top banks if an emergency were to arise. After the TARP debacle, the bankers have figured out how to rob us more efficiently. There's no point in asking the taxpayers for the money anymore. Turns out the American people hate that idea. So then they just go to the Fed and get the money from them. That's much easier. It's all good until we realize there might be a downside to the Fed printing $2 trillion. When inflation hits along with unemployment, we'll be back at the fun times of stagflation. But the bankers will have all gotten much richer by then, so mission accomplished. Matt Taibbi is a political reporter and a writer for Rolling Stone. I just mentioned him earlier. He joins us now. How are you, Matt?
How's it going, Jack?
Good, good.
You again?
It's good, except for all this QE nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
QE makes my head hurt.
All right, so look, I want to understand how they buy stuff, because that's really important, right? So the Fed will print money, will buy new things. What are they buying, and how are they buying them?
Well, first of all, just going to back up and realize that this is really the third strategy for stimulating the economy. The first two we've already done. You can slash interest rates to nothing to stimulate the economy, but we're already at zero. We've already done that. You can have the government, you know, hire people to build bridges and roads. We've already done that to the tune of almost $800 billion. So this is the third and last strategy, which is just to print a whole bunch of money and buy stuff with it. And they already did one round of this. They did over $1.5 trillion of buying mortgages and treasury bonds. That was called QE1, and that was between March of 2009 and March of this year. And now they're going to do another round of this where they just go out and they buy a whole bunch of treasury bonds and probably a little bit of mortgages too, and that's how they're going
to
do it.
See, that's the part I understand. When you go to the mortgages, buy the mortgages, I know that they bought toxic mortgages the first time around. They're buying new mortgages. Well, who determines the price, and what do the banks get to pick their worst mortgages? I mean, why do they want to sell their good mortgages? You see what I'm saying?
Well, from what I understand, this is sort of a wink-wink kind of nudge-nudge system where the people at the Fed basically talk to the guys at the banks and they say, we're going to be buying a whole bunch of X, so you should load up on X, and then in a week and a half or so, you can sell it all to us. So they go out into the market, and it's sort of this informal, like you said, it's basically a bailout of the banks. If you're at, say, you know, one of those big banks, multinational banks, you go out and you buy a whole bunch of Fannie Mae's or whatever it is, and then in a week and a half's time, you can go and sell it to the Fed above market rates, and it's basically free money.
Oh, well, that's a good scam. Can I get in on it?
No, you can't. That's kind of the key thing. And the other thing is, you know, when you buy this stuff, when you sell this stuff to the Fed, you have to keep the money at the Fed where you can now collect interest. That money just sits there and it collects a small amount of interest. So, again, it's just basically free money for the banks.
So, like, let's say it's $100 and then today, right, a mortgage is an example.
Right.
And they know the Fed's going to buy it at $120, so they go out and buy it at $105, whatever.
They buy a billion of these mortgages at $100, and then next week they're selling it at $120 or whatever it is.
So, but now the mortgage isn't actually worth $120.
No.
And so when the Fed loses money on it, like,
right.
I assume at some point they sell it, right?
Well,
so
yeah.
What happens when the Fed loses money?
Well, I mean, the future consequences of all this stuff are just dastardly on all sides. I mean, remember remember, if all this money ends up into the in the economy, you're just suddenly releasing $2 trillion or $2.5 trillion into the economy, and next thing you know, it's like a friend of mine said, "Where's Zimbabwe?" I mean, the dollar is going to be toilet paper. It's you have a hyperinflationary situation, and that's a disaster. I mean, there are all kinds of potential negative consequences of this that really are a disaster to even think about.
So when we have the inflation, that you know, at this point we're not worried about it, but soon we're going to be if you pump in all this money. I remember like the old days of Argentina when they would just keep printing money and then it wound up in a disaster. How does that hurt the average guy?
Well, because his money's worth less. I mean, you know, once the dollar is depreciated, if you have money in your bank account and, you know, it's worth, you know, three quarters of what it was a few months ago, then you've lost all that money. And you're basically that money is gone to subsidize capitalizing the banks. It's a straight-up capital transfer from ordinary people who have savings to banks that are now making profits.
And who runs the Fed that makes this decision? I mean, obviously we got Bernanke, right? But who's behind Bernanke?
Well, I mean, it's the presidents of the individual Federal Reserves. You know, the New York Fed is obviously a big power in all of this. But the important thing to remember about all this is that the Federal Reserve officials are not really elected officials. I mean, obviously they're appointed by an elected official. But none of this stuff, there's no referendum on this program by any elected officials, really. I mean, think about the brouhaha there was over an $800 billion stimulus. That was a massive national controversy. And here you have a program that's probably twice that size and doesn't even involve real money. It's money we're inventing out of thin air, and you hear almost nothing about it. It's really amazing.
Right. And the banks are the ones that pick a lot of the people on the New York Fed, right?
Right.
The banks.
Obviously,
so
yes.
It's the banks paying themselves. Right. So, I mean, that's a good racket.
Yeah,
right?
It's a great racket if you can get a part of it.
Right, exactly. And so is this a way of doing the biggest bank robbery of all time?
Yeah.
You know, basically, where the banks decide, hey, you know what, we're going to pay ourselves, and eventually your money's going to be worthless, but that's not our problem, it's your problem.
Right. It's great for them in the short term, it's terrible for us in the long term, and it's just one of another of these long lines of bank robberies that have been going on in the last 2.5 years. I mean, you know, if you borrow money at 0% interest and lend it back to the government at 3% interest, I mean, that's also a bank robbery. This kind of stuff has been going on under everybody's noses, and nobody really does anything about it, and it's kind of amazing.
Matt, real quick, last thing here. Did they figure out, oh, my God, why am I right about this? Why the hell are we going to the taxpayers? They don't like this stuff. Let's just do an end run around it, and let's just go to the Fed and just print the money.
Right, exactly.
Is that right? Is that the new scam?
Right. I mean, effectively, it works out that way. I mean, everybody who's involved with this will have a justification for it. They'll all say, we're doing this because we're desperate to kickstart the economy. But, you know, on an individual level, it works out great for a whole lot of the people involved, and you have to wonder about their motives.
Gee, I wonder. Rolling Stones, Matt Taibbi, you're doing some great work on this story. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
All right. So that tells you. People Charmy, a consumer lawyer with Jacksonville Area Legal Aid, CNB's Dennis Neal, noted in February 2009 that courts have found that some mortgages have been sold again and again to different trusts when they should have only been sold once.
Oh.
And Neal explained that this is the reason why two different banks sometimes try to simultaneously foreclose on the same home. Oh, this is good.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, this is a good one. Let's do it.
You want me to invest in what?
Oh, sorry.
Imported ice?
People love imported water, so this is the next logical step.
I think I'll stick with following my green line.
Work with a company that's helping more people reach retirement than anyone else. Fidelity Investments.
15 seconds of misery.
This next segment may outrage some of you. A legal aid lawyer in Florida has helped hundreds of homeowners stay in their homes long after defaulting on their mortgages. When banks file foreclosure actions, April Charney takes them to court and shows that the banks can't prove they really own these loans at all. Joining me now is April Charney of Jacksonville Area Legal Aid. And for the record, just to reveal, April and I actually went to high school together. I remember on the high school newspaper, she complained that my questioning was always too dogmatic. Let's hope we can do some of that today. April, why should a guy who can't pay his mortgage be allowed to stick around just because of a paperwork error?
It's not a paperwork error. It's a problem across the industry that the originating lenders did not transfer these loans as they promised the SEC they would do to the securitized trust.
to securitize trust. But still, the fact is these people borrowed this money, they got it from somewhere, and now they haven't paid it back. And doesn't a person get thrown out of their home when they do that?
Well, you have to know who to pay your debt to. And all of the people that I represent do want to make good on their home loans. They just need to know who owns their loans so that they can access loan workouts to make sure they stay as performing on their home loans.
Okay. April, as your old friend, I want to tell you, rev it up a little bit. Let's have a little passion. Let's bring in a little help on my side. Let's bring in Dan Mitchell from the Cato Institute. Dan, is there something wrong with this picture here?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speak about whether the loan servicers have crossed every T and dotted every I, but what I can tell you is that the more of this that goes on in the country, the more it's going to be hard, especially for low-income people in the future, to get loans. We're going to have higher interest rates for home mortgages if we have this kind of thing going on. Now, this may be legitimate about paperwork not being properly filed. I have no idea. But I do know there are groups out there like Acorn that practice extortion, and the ultimate victims of that are low-income people.
April, are you practicing extortion?
Oh, no. This is definitely requiring the securitized trust to comply with the agreements that they made pursuant to what the SEC requires to have securities sold on Wall Street.
Yeah, so it doesn't have anything to do with anybody's ability to pay. I mean, when Dennis was describing this yesterday, we all sat around, and all being self-interested individuals, we said, gosh, I wonder if I could figure out whether or not somebody really does or doesn't own my loan. Then, I mean, in theory, right, anybody could try to get around not paying their mortgage because of the dispute over the ownership of the mortgage, right?
The issue is that every loan, every home loan in America comes with mandatory special default loan servicing because homeowners go in and out of financial harm, as we're really seeing now in our economy. And the fact that the owners of our loans have failed to do anything other than create a Ponzi scheme that is bringing down our economy is not something that the folks that I represent should be burdened by.
Right.
My homeowners want to work out their loans. They just need the real
right.
party.
Dan, hang on, April. Hang on. Hey, Dan, you know, to April's point, she does point out that some of these loans, it's been found in court rulings, were sold again and again to different trusts when they should have been sold only once. She's pointed out that in some cases, homeowners get foreclosure notices from two different banks that think they each own the loan because they were sold it by a packager or a securities firm or something. Why should a homeowner get forced out of his home if indeed the banks can't prove that they have the title? Maybe no one owns it, Dan.
Well, again, if there are technical mistakes that the banks are making or the ultimate owners of securitized mortgages are making, then it is the job of a court to say, no, you can't foreclose on someone until you have the paperwork done right. What I'm concerned about, though, is that if there are people that aren't paying their mortgages and they're getting away with it, it's going to tell people that, hey, homeownership is just a scam. You get someone to give you money, you don't pay it back. And whether it's a technical court case or whether it's the politicians in Washington, you get out of honoring your side of a contract, that is a very bad message to send. And that's happening all over the place in Washington.
Well, one last thing,
car companies, banks,
you trained 2,000 lawyers in this technique right across the country. This is not an isolated Florida thing. We're going to see this show up more.
This is a systemic across the industry. This is essentially a $3 to $7 trillion Ponzi scheme. This is not something that I created. This was created by the industry and the failure of regulatory action. We need to fix this. Our country needs to take back these loans because nobody owns them. We need to restructure them, format them into performing loans, and then perhaps sell them back on the private
market. All right. Good final shot there, April. Nice job. Thanks, guys. Thanks for being with us, Dan.
Absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So if everybody could just stop paying their mortgage, you know, it might be amazing. Looks like that's what people are doing.
They don't blame them.
You're getting the idea. From global depression to global governance. I don't know if I want to go this way, but I've been warning about this forever. What do you think?
Well,
we now stand at the edge of the global financial abyss of the great global depression, where nations mired in extreme debt are beginning to implement fiscal austerity measures to to reduce their deficits, which will ultimately result in systematic global social genocide. As the middle classes vanish and the social foundations upon which our nations rest are swept away, how did we get here? Who brought us here? And where is this road leading? These are questions I will briefly attempt to answer. And this is by somebody. Let's say. At the end of the global political economy and the central banking system, central banks are responsible for printing a nation's currency and setting interest rates, thus determining the value of the currency. This should no doubt be the prerogative of a national government. However, central banks are a particularly deceptive nature, in which while they're being imbued with governmental authority, they are in fact privately owned by the world's major global banks and are thus profit-seeking institutions. How do central banks make a profit? The answer is simple. How do all banks make a profit? Interest on debt. Loans are made, interest rates are set, profits are made. It is a system of debt, imperial economics at its finest. The United States President Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act 1913, created the Federal Reserve System and the board located in Washington appointed by the President, but where true powers rested in the 12 regional banks, most notably among them the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The regional Fed banks were private banks owned in shares by the major banks in each region, and elected the board members to represent them, and who would then share power in the Federal Reserve Board in Washington. This is this goes on and on and on, but I got to tell you, that's really too long to read. But you know, if you want to take a look at it, go to globalresearch.ca and check out Global Depression to Global Governance. It's a good article, but it's just too long to cover here tonight. Let's see. NATO transfers Taliban leaders to Kabul. 12 Israeli jets violate Lebanon airspace. Interesting.
Oh, this one? Yeah.
Terrorist truther convicted for being on TV show.
Well, that should be interesting.
Yeah. Let's see what Yasmin.
Yasmin Cass.
Let's see what that's about.
Yes.
Okay, tell me what why you're here today.
I'm here to speak about my father, Mohammed Hamid. He was wrongly accused of terrorism in the year 2005. He was wrongly accused under the Terrorism Act of 2000. He was accused of paintballing and camping. Paintballing is not illegal in the United Kingdom. It is an activity that many people do to just have fun. BBC4 actually paid for him to do this documentary and encouraged him to do paintballing to show activities within the Muslim community of what Muslims actually do in the community. So paintballing was one of the activities that BBC4 actually paid for him to go and do. Then they later on used this documentary in court for evidence to accuse him of training under the Terrorism Act. So it's really, really pathetic, you know, that someone can be charged with training by going paintballing and camping.
Well, was this the major evidence against him?
Yeah, the major evidence was camping and paintballing.
Because he was training to be a terrorist.
This is what they were trying to imply and say, yes.
Well, you know your father. Can you believe he was training to be a terrorist?
No, not at all. I mean, he's 100% innocent. You know, I went to the court and I was sitting in the court case for the whole 6 months listening to, you know, the prosecution and all their skeletons and all their mishaps of, you know, just trying to convict someone on something that they didn't really have much evidence to provide for. So the only evidence they could provide was showing them paintballing, which was a documentary for BBC4, and camping.
It took 6 months? Why did it take 6 months?
Because the jury was just confused. The jury just didn't know what to do. You know, they couldn't reach a verdict. They had so many... I mean, the prosecution actually had a couple people come in to give witness statements. There were two police officers from Cumbria Wells. They were obviously paid by the prosecution to give statements on seeing these group of so-called Muslim men in the fields, and they both stated that they were doing military style training and stuff. So when it came to court, I mean, my father's QC said, well, how can they have been doing military training when both of you have claimed that you're both from military training backgrounds? So how could that be? So we realised that someone was lying. We looked back to both of their statements, and they had identical police statements. So they were both lying under oath, you know, and they actually got caught bang to rights in the courtroom where they got cleared on those charges, and we weren't to say anything else of it. You know, the media and the press weren't allowed to put that in the media.
Let's accept that your father was innocent. He's nevertheless been targeted. Why was he singled out?
I think my father was singled out because he had an impact on the community. He used to have a stall on Marble Arch from Monday to Saturday on the corner of Oxford Street, where he was distributing a lot of literature on the conspiracies of 9/11, the conspiracy of 7/7, Zionism in Israel, and all these documentaries about secret societies, the Masons, and, you know, he was well known within the community. He used to go Speaker's Corner on a Sunday as well and, like, you know, speak for the whole of Speaker's Corner, and I just think he was victimised for the knowledge he had and all the information he had and that he was distributing. They didn't want him on the streets doing what he was doing, so they had to find a reason to get him away. You know, they had to put him behind bars, like, you know, like Nelson Mandela and all the other people that have been victimized for freedom of speech.
So maybe this Channel 4 documentary was even part of a setup and a stitch-up.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I sincerely believe it was. I mean, I've worked closely with Phil Rees and Nazreen Suleiman, who were the actual people who were paid to do the documentary for BBC 4. Phil actually asked me when I last spoke to him that, do I actually blame him? And I said, I do, but I don't blame him individually. I blame the people that were working behind closed doors using him as the guinea pig, you know, because when we tried to get access to the actual documentary, they couldn't find it. It had gone missing from the office. You know, they said somebody took it to go and take to the school to show children about other cultures in life and stuff. And, you know, it was just like, you know, Secret Service losing all their logbooks.
Okay, finally, what would you ask anyone that's looking at this video? What would you ask them to do?
I would ask them to help me in my campaign, just to help me free my father and to help me in my campaign to just stop this from happening to any other family. And to speak up about what you know within the case and what actually happened. I would like for people like Attila, who was one of the Cody's arrested with my father, to speak out against, like, speak about what really happened to him in the cell. You know, why did he crumble and go guilty, and what did they actually do to him? You know, I want to know the truth.
So he was arrested with someone else who pleaded guilty.
After crumbling, yeah, you know, they actually went for the weakest one out of the lot. You know, he was suffering panic attacks in his cell. He was going crazy. You know, he was shaving off his beard, going mad, not knowing what to do. And I think they just victimised him and said, look, if you go guilty, we'll do such and such. You know, and it's all worked out in his favour now, because he's actually walking the streets now, while my father's the one who's left inside with this hefty, hefty sentence on him, you know. And they just think it's okay to get on with their normal life, and I'm not going to kick up a stink. Well, I am. You know, I'm going to kick up a big stink, you know, and I just hope I don't get into trouble along the way. But, you know, the most I can do is get my voice to be heard. And I really could do with some support from the Muslim community, because everybody who's helping me at the moment, they're not Muslim. They're not like my brother or sister, you know. They're meant to be the ones that help me, but they don't help me. So, you know, I really do appreciate the help from Parting Clouds and Bridget and all the other Stop the War campaign and all these peaceful protesters who are actually helping me speaking out against the injustice of my father's harsh sentence.
I guess this might not go in the video, but I guess the Muslim community feels in a state of fear and frenzy in general.
Yeah, they are. I mean, I'm very fearful too, but I don't want this to happen to my children or another friend who lives next door. I don't want them to go through these things. So the most I can do is raise my voice in what's going on.
Thank you.
Poor girl.
Yeah, so her father was convicted.
He was a truther, and he was convicted of being on TV.
Yeah, as a terrorist because he was doing paintball. Pretty sick.
Probably because of all the other stuff.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Not that was an excuse.
Yep. Okay, I wanted to. I was thinking.
Charge homeowners up to 18% in interest. If you don't pay, you lose your house.
It's a ripoff of property owners. For those who are simply out to maximize their return, it's a great way to make a buck. The question becomes, do you mind being a vulture?
It's been a booming business in some of the areas hardest hit by the recession. Investors say they perform a public service by providing quick cash to local governments in dire need of revenue. But now some investors are facing scrutiny from federal and local authorities. In Washington, D.C., the Attorney General is accusing one investor of charging homeowners excessive fees.
It's a very fertile ground for fraud and deception.
It's also a business the Wall Street isn't talking about. As we pulled records from around the country, we unraveled the web of obscure companies operating out of drop boxes and desolate office parks. Despite the anonymity, we traced the companies back to about a dozen big banks and hedge funds.
Well, if major banks are involved, there's got to be some big money.
We called the banks over and over again for weeks, but they refused to talk. So we went to New York City to pay them a visit.
Now we're going to J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and several other banks that have been involved in this business. And we're just basically trying to ask them some standard questions. Why are they involved? Has their involvement picked up since they were bailed out? Let's see what we get.
J.P. Morgan owns a company called Expand, also known as Plymouth Park Tax Services. As one of the largest tax lien investors in the country, it has relieved cash-strapped cities of millions of dollars in unpaid debts. But some homeowners say they're the ones bearing the cost.
My name is Sheila Rice. This is my mother and father's house. We've been here over 40 years. Got a lot of memories. Now it's in tax trouble. I had my own room.
Rice, who lives in Maryland, fell behind on her property taxes when she lost her job in 2006. Before she was able to catch up, Plymouth Park bought her delinquent bills. She had never heard of Plymouth Park. But the company's local lawyer charged her more than $2,000 in fees, in addition to the back taxes she owed.
I didn't have any way to pay a lump sum, and they told me they wouldn't take partial payments.
They said, pay up or we'll take your home. She put her house up for sale to cover the debt. When we told her that Plymouth Park is owned by J.P. Morgan, she was outraged.
I felt like Mr. J.P. Morgan had a vendetta against me, and I don't even know this man.
What did J.P. Morgan have to say when they called us back?
Hi, Brian. It's Ben Protest. You're not going to participate. I understand that you said it three times, but I would really just like to have 5 minutes of your time. We've traveled all the way from D.C. No? Thank you.
Like J.P. Morgan, Bank of America finances companies that have spent millions on tax liens. But that connection is hardly clear because the companies have names like Investments 2234, or Bennu, or Ekru, and they all do business from the same post office box in Atlanta.
So we're walking up to Bank of America. We're trying to get a hold of these guys for a couple of days. Just ringing, not getting any answers so far.
A half hour later, a Bank of America spokeswoman called us back.
This is Ben. So there's no one today that can talk to us?
Striking out with the banks, we moved on to a major hedge fund named Fortress Investment Group. It manages more than $41 billion in assets and is led by former Fannie Mae CEO Daniel Mudd. This year, 17 companies affiliated with Fortress plowed millions into tax liens in Florida. We asked to speak with someone at Fortress, but were denied access once again.
They won't talk to us. They refuse to have any conversation with us, even for 5 minutes. And they wouldn't even confirm what floor they're on in this building.
We weren't giving up. We crossed the river to New Jersey, where some banks operate their tax lien divisions. We started with one of the companies that's connected to the Fortress Group. It's called Tower Capital Management. We went to the Morristown, New Jersey address listed on Tower's website, Suite 3000, only they weren't listed on the building's directory, and there was no Suite 3000. We tried the third floor instead.
We're here at Tower Capital Management, and it's about 3:40 in the afternoon. No one's home. All we have to show is the sign that appears to be printed off and taped on, which shows Tower Capital Management, whereas down in the directory downstairs, there's no record of a Tower Capital Management, and we've talked to a few people in the building, and they have no idea who Tower Capital Management is.
No, well, they were something else. Now they have a new name, but I don't usually see people in there.
Okay.
I think I might have seen people go in there a couple times, but usually it's all dark in there.
Just down the road is an address listed to Expand, the J.P. Morgan company, which also goes by the name Plymouth Park.
Is the company named Expand in here?
I don't know. There's a directory right here.
Okay. Thank you very much.
What we're finding here is just a vacant suite. So I'm not sure what exactly is going on.
A UPS delivery man tells us they left a year ago.
Well, now we're going to take off and go to the other possible location for Expand.
So We're outside Expand headquarters in Whippany, New Jersey. The only thing they'll do is show us a number of someone to call in New York. We already called this morning and won't talk to us. We did confirm that it is J.P. Morgan's building. We had one final stop on our journey, the Sears Tower in Chicago, where another investor, Aon Financial, is located. They, too, declined to talk to us. Aon has worked with TCF, a Midwestern bank, to purchase liens across the country. We walked down the street to visit Aon's law firm, the company sending threatening collection notices to homeowners. The address listed on the notices? A drop box at a UPS store.
Anonymity is a big problem.
The District of Columbia's Attorney General also wants to know who's behind Aon and is suing them to find out.
So this is a scheme whereby Aon and others associated with Aon are ripping off the homeowners for fees that are much too high.
Aon denies the charges. Nichols, meanwhile, says the company isn't the only investor he's scrutinizing.
I mean, this is one of the areas that really needs to get a good scrubbing.
That's how Rice feels. She ended up selling her longtime family home to avoid foreclosure.
I can see that the county needs their taxes because clearly we need the finances to run the city, but these people add so much more to the original bill that there's no way to climb out from under it. It's like warehousing people into poor houses.
Oh, boy. And they'll never, ever be able to get another house.
No. But nobody cares.
They'll be pushed down into the lower class, and that'll be it.
That poor lady, she lost her job in 2006, and she finally... But, you know, they banged her for $2,000, $3,000 more. It's crazy. Well, anyway, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to thank everybody for listening, and hopefully you got some kind of a... some information on what's going on bank-wise.
What the globalists are doing.
Yeah,
they seem to be popping up everywhere. It's like a plague with no, there's nothing you can do about it. You almost feel like there's no measure that you can take to stop them, because the minute you squish them down one place, they pop up another place.
It's
like an infection.
Well,
good night, folks. Have a good night, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay.
Well, Leo will anyway.
Okay, we want to thank everybody for joining us, and hope you had an interesting evening. I'm going to leave you with this rant by Dylan Radigan. Let's see what that's all about. I kind of missed it. I guess it was yesterday.
We begin with the now famous walkout on The View, where Whoopi and Joy left the live show in protest of Bill O'Reilly's Oh, my God!
You return.
O'Reilly, I think they...
You invite me on the show?
Really? I support Whoopi and Joy.
I mean, for me, I guess what I would say is there's a core issue here, which is there is a small group of well-funded Wahhabi extremists funded by the Saudi Arabian government to whom we give money. You invite me on the show, what's going to happen, okay? It is American oil money and American guns to the Saudi Arabian government. Those guns, that money, to Wahhabi extremist Muslims in Saudi Arabia, the only ones who have ever killed us. Them. We are not at war with Islam. We are not at war with Muslims. We are not at war with Afghanistan. We are not at war with Iraq, Iran. It's nonsense. So yes, they hold signs, "I hate America." Have you seen the signs we hold? The only people that have ever funded a terrorist attack out of that part of the world on us, on your colleagues and your colleagues and your colleagues 9 years ago, was this Wahhabi sect, and it is an extraordinary failure of our politicians and our media and our anybody else who has an opportunity to communicate information to fail to make that distinction, because to fail to make that distinction is to risk a scale of conflict and a scale of disenfranchisement and alienation on this planet that may be convenient for TV ratings and votes, but is an abomination for the human beings who populate this planet. planet, and it's a lie.
So you have referenced, to my mind, the most valid point that Bill O'Reilly made, and it is that in the wake of everything that has occurred around the world since September 11th and before September
11th, yes,
the coal bombing,
yes,
the leadership of the Muslim world has remained uniquely silent about what has happened. I mean, you get no encyclical from the Muslim world about,
because ultimately they think about the dynamic in the Muslim world. That the Muslim world, there you have different factions that are trying to retain their power relative to other factions within that community, and there are, that includes factions that do not want to see Saudi strength rise, or that don't want to see Iranian strength rise, and see Iranian strength as something that can be balanced through other forces. But that's beside the point, which is, in my opinion, which is that whether it's leadership in the Middle East or leadership in America, the failure to make the distinction between the Wahhabi sect that is funded through Saudi money and all other Islam, period. Even, I don't care whether it's Islam or angry, saying I hate Americans, you got a sign. Like I said, go to Ground Zero, go to Florida, I'll show you some signs. Are we going to, since when are we going to go to war over a sign?
Well, I was just going to say, to that argument, you know, you could say any group that's trying to protect themselves is always uniquely silent. Say that about the Catholic Church was uniquely silent.
Mm-hmm.
And it needed to be. My issue with this, we talked around this in the last 3 hours, two of the hours I was awake for. But what's interesting is that, to me, it's more about, Dylan, you make that point about ratings, is that it's Bill O'Reilly going on the
politicians
to talk about this so they can go back to the respective shows and talk about it. And even us, we talk about it. It's interesting television, but it's almost like this unique sort of ecosphere where we're just feeding each other, and nobody, Oprah is going on the Daily Show with Colbert. I mean, it's just us talking about us talking about us.
But there's a real issue, which is,
there is a real issue,
the information distortion and the fear-mongering and the amount of money and the amount of power that can be accumulated in this country and other countries through the distortion and exploitation of religious fear and racial fear in exchange for having decent, honest exchange of real information, which is, you know what, most Muslims don't even care about you. And the vast majority of the ones that don't like you from the couch, and there aren't that many of them. And the ones that actually want to kill you, about this many, and it's not because they're Muslim, it's because they've been radicalized, and they have been, the religion has been used as a teaching mechanism, as sure as Christianity or any other religion could be, but it is not the fact that they are Muslims that makes them terrorists, it is the fact that they are terrorists that makes them terrorists. And that is a massive distinction that I think has been uniformly not made in this country, because I think it strikes to the cognitive dissonance of these huge wars. You have, if we're not at war with Islam, well then would somebody please tell me why it is we're a few $1 trillion up and we've got a few thousand dead soldiers to fight all these wars in all these Middle Eastern countries? Because I thought we were at war with Islam, which is why we've got all these tanks and Predator drones flying everywhere. If we're just at war with a narrow group of well-funded, well-organized extremists out of Saudi Arabia and in that region, well, then can somebody please explain, it's tough to explain the policies in that context. If we're at war with Islam, if we're at war with the Muslims, well, then my goodness, I mean, there's got to be 10 more countries we've got to go to war with, right? It is an obscene concept, and it's shameful to me that anybody, from the president down, doesn't make an extraordinarily strong distinction between those two things.
That was true. And we'll go from there. So I want to thank everybody for joining us. And I want to remind them to please join me tomorrow when we go to third dimension. Okay. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for joining me and wish you a good night. And join me tomorrow.